Dr. Ailey Cohen, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me, Jacob. I appreciate it.
For those who don't know your fantastic work, what do you do?
So I'm a physician. I've been practicing medicine for 22 years here in the United States. I started off as my regular training here in internal medicine, and then I went off to do a subspecialty in rheumatology, which is also immune system, academics. And then I went into integrative medicine training, which unfortunately I didn't get during my medical school training, which is on nutrition and diet. I learned a little bit about environmental health as well at that point. And so now I'm basically seeing patients, combining all my areas of training, and then writing, doing a lot of books and curriculum for teaching organizations.
So what inspired you to blend all of those things together in the first place?
You know, I don't think I had any intention of blending them. I actually was just going with my interest. I was so interested in the immune system, which is why I went into that subspecialty. Then my dog became very sick early on, about 15 years ago. I write about it in my new book. I've written about it in even previous books, where my dog, you know, was 4.5-year-old golden retriever, and he became very sick with autoimmune hepatitis, which is where his body's immune system was triggered against his own liver, which is very rare in dogs, but it's incredibly rare in golden retrievers. And I was trying to understand why and how he got sick. And as I was trying to explore topics of drinking water and air quality and pesticides where we lived and dog food and flea and tick chemicals and all that, I was uncovering just a multitude of studies and information about how humans are affected by these chemicals as well. In fact, in the U.S., you know, more so than Europe, in a much bigger way. And it led me into a career of environmental health. So I was putting together that with all of the immune and autoimmune disease cases I was seeing as a rheumatologist here in my office. And it all just came together for me to this moment where I'm really talking to lots of people in every way I can about how to manage these environmental chemicals that we've created in modern day times.
I remember you mentioning something about your dog's like red plastic toy. How did that play a part in his kind of illness and death eventually?
You know, it's interesting. At the time, I didn't have any history I was rolling up to McDonald's and having, you know, hot deluxe breakfasts while I was pregnant, right? I'm a worse offender when I talk about this book. I mean, I still color my hair. The thing is like at that time, it was just, I had no clue that chemicals were even a problem. I assumed, at least in the U.S., that everything that was on the shelf was already tested. It was already regulated. Someone was overseeing it. But it was interesting to find that, you know, the more I uncovered about plastics in general, the more I started to identify how plastic chemicals get into the human body, into pets. And my golden retriever at the time, you know, he was basically living and breathing this red toy, very popular dog toy. But it was in his mouth even while he slept. So around the clock, he had these mucous membranes of his mouth really absorbing and swallowing these chemicals. I can't for sure say that he in any way got this diagnosis from that exposure, but it really opened up my eyes to the fact that many exposures can trigger the immune system in ways that we never expected, the ways that were never tested back then. Now we know so much more about how these chemicals work, not only against the immune system in terms of how it functions normally, but also affecting hormones and how the endocrine system works in the human body as well.
When do you know if the rough estimate of the time when people found out that plastics have negative health implications on us?
Yeah, you know, I work with a lot of researchers now. And when I first got into this 15 years ago, I was basically reading the headlines like anyone else, if there were any headlines. I was reading medical studies that I found on our medical study, websites like PubMed.gov, which is our U.S. database for published medical journals, peer review studies. And I was actually starting to look at the first and second authors of all of these papers that I was self-taught at the beginning. I had no resources. No one ever told me this was a problem, even in medical school. So I started reaching out to these folks that were writing and doing the research. And this was starting to become international work. But one of the key players in a lot of what I was studying was someone named Dr. Frederick von Saal, who at the time had really looked at bisphenol A or BPA, which is a particular type of plastic It lines the interior of all cans. It's in lots of different products. It's probably the largest, industrial chemical that's used throughout the U.S. in so many different ways. And he and his colleagues had stumbled across the fact that one of the mouse studies came out, with really odd results, and they tracked it back to the plastic watering bottle feeder for the mice. And so it had thrown off their results, in short. And so then they're like, well, why? Why is this? So then they started looking at plastics, and it really, opened up an entire world of science that went against traditional toxicology. And this is 25 years ago, but it began this whole movement. And the idea being that some of these chemicals, which he discovered as well, are endocrine disrupting chemicals, meaning that they can work at very, very, very low doses, similar to where the mice were exposed, and do the same things as very high dose exposures. So instead of the classic toxicology premise by Paracelsus in the 1500s, where like dose makes the poison, where it's linear, the more you're exposed to something, it's linearly, you have response. Fred Romsahl and his colleagues and lots of others were now starting to see that you could get very low doses up here doing the same thing as even high doses. And no one bothered to look at this, kind of component of the charting. So, they had to come up with different ways, different assays to be able to study chemicals working like hormones, because hormones work like that. Very, very low doses can have really enormous physiologic effects. And that's what chemicals were starting to kind of show up and that's how they acted.
So I read a book, a few pages of a book recently, a few days ago, actually, about the gut. And the author was talking about a Mediterranean diet and kind of what to eat. And he included talking about fish and how they're high in omega-3, etc. Then he spoke about tuna and kind of compared the amount of mercury in parts per million of tuna compared to other fish like swordfish. Yeah. And swordfish was about 0.9 something parts per million. And then tuna was 0.128. around that parts per million. And he said, because tuna is so low in mercury compared to swordfish, it's not actually that bad for your health. Does what you're saying completely disprove that, or is it applicable to mercury?
I will say, I don't know the study. I don't know this. I always trip lately when it comes to what other people present to me. But what I will say is this, what we do know is that bigger fish, in this case, swordfish is bigger than tuna, I'm assuming, in this particular, depends on what type of tuna and where it comes from. But big fish bioaccumulate chemicals up the food chain. So when you have a big fish, it eats middle or medium fish and small fish, and then the medium fish, they'll eat smaller fish, and then the smaller fish will eat algae. And so this chain of events means that there's an accumulation of the chemicals that are in each of those things that the big fish eats. Right. So you see more higher levels of PCBs, which polychlorinated biphenyls, which are, industrial chemicals. You see higher levels of methylmercury. You see higher levels of microplastics, actually, which is a whole nother topic. Okay. And so what we're seeing is that the big fish tend to be the problems more often than the smaller fish. Small fish can have problems as well. And middle fish, because it depends on if they're farm raised. It depends if they're wild caught. If they're sustainably raised, if they're raised in nets or they're raised out in the ocean, there's lots of variability there. But in turn, and it also depends on what body of water. I mean, there are certain bodies of water that are much more contaminated with runoff, manufacturing, sewage than there might be in another part of the world where that might flip entirely. There's also a lot of new data, which was interesting when I studied it, where fish that are also high in selenium might offset the effects from mercury exposure in that same fish. So then there was an argument of whether or not the ratio of mercury to selenium would be a better indicator of health of a fish in terms of exposures to toxins. But the idea really sticks to the idea that smaller wild caught fish tend to be a little bit less exposed to the chemicals in the oceans. But they are remarkably healthy. I just limit with my patients. I talk about in the book, I just limit how many servings of fish per week and look for other sources of omega-3s and protein and some of these nutrients. Because unfortunately, we have to worry about this problem in our fish population, which we never used to have to decades ago, right?
Yeah, that leads me to a following question of I go to the gym basically every day. and I'm obviously a student, so I kind of have a budget, right? And skipjack canned tuna has like at least 25 grams of protein and 20 grams of protein. And I absolutely love it. And I have it every day for breakfast. But the more I've kind of researched your work, the more I'm realizing, is it actually safe to have that amount like 7 days a week? And how would I know, or how would someone know who's also eating a similar amount of something high in mercury, how they know whether they're like, that's healthy or not for them? Like what the
symptoms? It's a great question. And even when you said cans of skipjack, you're now also getting the canned liner. Typically, not always, but certainly the plastic epoxy lining is part of every canned food or drink, even if it's organic. I know you have that in your country as well. But the idea that we have to think about so many things, what I did with the book that I wrote was I really wanted to walk people through sort of what are the big things to think about, the big ticket items, and then you would sort of walk yourself through. Now, what you're describing is a habit. And when I think about habits, I think to myself, that's a high load exposure, right? Because you're doing it every day, you're used to it, it's hard to change habits. And so that's something where I would explore whether or not you could find that same food in glass. I would also, perhaps you just, look to see where, if they're doing mercury testing on that brand. It's a kind of a thing now for some of the biggest companies will do mercury testing. They won't necessarily do microplastics because that's not a thing yet in manufacturing. And they don't do PCBs. But the idea is one of the key things is to see whether or not you can even test your own whole blood mercury level. And in fact, in the book in the United States here, and you guys have it in the US, in the UK now, Detoxify. So the equivalent of what are called ICD-10 codes are the codes that doctors put on a script to go to the lab that's covered by insurance here in the US. And that justifies why that test was ordered. And I give that here in the States. And so you can really ask your healthcare provider, whoever prescribes labs, to see if they will do a random whole blood, mercury level as just one indicator of maybe you're getting too much. But there's, again, you want to live your life. You want to have your protein. I know I got two guys that go to the gym every day, but you want to try and find clean sources of protein. And there is also a lot of USDA organic sources of powdered protein, of other types of, whole chicken and fish and meat. You can even get plant-based protein. And so I would say maybe you want to mix it up a little bit, but you can sort of check at your labs to see if that's something that's affecting you.
Yeah. So do you have any kind of suggestions of things to like completely replace the tuna with for breakfast?
Oh, well, I if you're not vegan, then I like to look at, chicken breasts, chicken thighs. I would say if you can get organic or, the equivalent of processed properly, chickens and poultry, turkey. I think the smaller fish, herring, sardines, them are even packaged. I think they're gross, but whatever. I mean, my people love these things, but small fish in glass, packed in glass, I think is a really nice way to, herring. All of these things can be done in a reasonable way and you can kind of mix it up. But certainly protein comes in lots of different packages and you can, get dairy sources. I do a lot of cottage cheese. I happen to love cottage cheese that's organic. Hummus has a lot of protein. So there's lots of different sources you can vary it up, I think.
What about whey protein? Have you done any research on that? What's in that?
Yeah, whey protein doesn't in any way bother me in any way. It's just more quality. I look through, so much of our environment, even on social media, is macros. It's like how much protein, how much fat, Whole30, keto diets, Mediterranean. I mean, you name the diet, Atkins, whatever. There's always a fad, right? And it's always about the macros of what you're eating. I worry far less about macros as I do the quality. And when I think quality, I think about where it's sourced, how it's packaged. I think about whether or not it's USDA organic, which is the only food certification we have in this country, in the US, because we have nothing else in terms of oversight, really, in terms of the food industry. Yeah, it's a real problem here because there have been grandfathered in thousands, actually around 12,000 estimated food chemicals that are food additives that are allowable, which have never really been tested for safety or toxicity. I mean, even dating back to 1958 with the food amendment that passed, which didn't do anything. So the idea is that we have very little regulation and oversight, but USDA organic certification took 10 years to bring to the market. and actually really is something we can all benefit from here in the States. I know the equivalent in the UK and Europe, you know, has the same criteria, similar, and really does a great job. I'm not sure. Do you eat a lot of organic foods?
Not enough, no.
Yeah. And is it more pricey over in the States, or what do you find about that?
When I'm at home, when I'm not at university, I'll probably eat more. My parents will go to like a farm shop, which is just like maybe even more organic than like a big chain store. But yeah. Organic food's definitely slightly more expensive in any shop. But obviously, if you can afford it, it is worth it.
Yeah. And frozen USDA organics here are really much cheaper and bring the price down. Plus, they have the added benefit of actually locking in nutrients because they're frozen, flash frozen. So I encourage local farmers to share how they, you know, grow their food and whether they use certain chemicals. I encourage local farming support. And nutrition-wise, when something is picked from the ground, it has the highest level of nutrient value. So I definitely encourage all that. But for all the folks that I'm used to seeing, you know, we don't all have that accessible even year-round. That's when USDA frozen foods are great. You just want to put them in glass and stainless steel to heat up so you don't get those added, packaging chemicals.
Yeah, I didn't even think to look in like freezers for like organic stuff. That's a good idea. Right?
Because we grew up thinking that everything that comes to the ground immediately is fresh, is great. But in our food system, at least here, it's actually one of the downsides is that food travels long distances. The soil quality isn't always so great. Some of these produce, they actually put in low temperature refrigerators for weeks on end before it gets the supermarket fresh section. So there's a lot about the food system that has changed over the last several decades. And, you know, this is just kind of working around the problem. Frozens are great, cheaper, accessible across the country, you know, nutrient rich, all of that.
Yeah, I'll definitely look into that. In simple terms, how would you define a toxin, if you can? Well,
so, you know, a toxin, so let me go back a second. You know, I got, you know, as a person who tries to get it right and be, you know, as a researcher, you know, toxin by definition is the wrong word that we use in everyday terminology. So really it should be toxic, T-O-X-I-C as a noun, right? A toxic is really a synthetic made compound. And a toxin is actually considered to be truly a toxin. It has to come from a living creature. So we think venom or something from a plant. And so technically we're all getting it wrong by calling it a toxin, but you have to meet people where they're at. So when you're writing a book or you're talking about this material, you have to say toxin because people are like, oh yeah, toxin. Essentially, you know, the colloquial terminology is really that, you know, it's just bad for the body and it can harm the body. So it's an overarching term that says basically it's like poison, right? And, you know, I would venture to say that not all chemicals are poisonous in the sense that you're going to, you know, be exposed and drop dead. It's more about how do these chemicals and which ones and where do they come from? How do they work insidiously to affect, you know, human beings and pets at the cellular level? And how do they really create an inflammatory response in the way that I talk about it, that can trigger actual clinical disease. So you can kind of be walking around feeling good, no big deal, but over time you might build up, you know, where your threshold is reached and you end up having or developing some type of inflammatory condition. So that's kind of what I'm trying to teach about toxins, toxics, is that we have a lot of them. We just need to know how and where they come from. And then we need to be empowered to reduce those exposures, which I, you know, I clearly try to do with the work I do.
Yeah. What are some common examples of autoimmune diseases that can
be? So there in the medical literature, there's upwards of about 80 of them. I mean, that's sort of the going number for how many are classically derived, written in Western, you know, textbooks and medical literature. I will tell you that there's a lot more, you know, syndromes that fall within those that have features of different autoimmune diseases, but don't get called classically an autoimmune disease, which actually works against a lot of patients in many ways because they look great on paper, but they don't feel good, or they have things that are not believable by many healthcare practitioners. But autoimmune diseases actually have been on the rise, not just in the US, but around the world, because we're a global world now. And the going estimate is in the US, 7 to 14%. of U.S. citizens, which is about 24 to 50 million people, 330, have one or more type of autoimmune disease. And that could be any range from really bad stuff to really, you know, no big deal, but simply diagnosed. And what we're seeing now around the world is the same thing, that there's been an increase, not just in autoimmune diseases being diagnosed, but also at younger ages with no family history. And that's concerning because that reminds me of my dog, right? He's getting sick at an age that's really young. He shouldn't even be having this illness. And so why is that happening, you know? And really, a lot of it may have to do with his environment and our environments shifting a lot of conditions that we might not have had as much exposure, but now we're having more and more exposures to a lot of different chemicals, and mixtures of them in the body also have been linked to higher rates and faster onset. So the goal is really to say, again, let's push back on these exposures. Let's not necessarily wait for regulation. You know, if you take one dye, red dye number 3 made a lot of news recently that they're, you know, trying to ban. First of all, they're not going to put that into effect for a couple of years, right? They're going to give manufacturers, of course, right? They get the biggest, you know, benefit. They get 2 or 3 years to just implement that into their products. And that's one of 10,000 food additives that potentially should be looked at for, you know, harm and toxicity. So in our lifetime, your lifetime, we're not going to have the ability to wait that out to protect us. We have to do it for ourselves.
Yeah, definitely. I definitely agree. We've mentioned mercury and BPA. What are some other really common toxics that we're exposed to on a daily basis?
So, you know, they come in different packages. So, for instance, as a young person, my kids, too, they love cologne. They love, you know, personal care products. They don't love cleaning products, I can assure you on that one. Your rooms are closed. But I will tell you that many of the cleaning and cosmetic products really actually share a lot of chemicals. And one of them is fragrance. Fragrances or perfume, if you look at a label on shampoo, conditioner, even cleaning products, that is actually a proprietary combination of chemicals and can be upwards of, you know, 200, 300 or 1,000. It doesn't matter. We're never going to know because it's considered sort of like the secret formula, like, you know, Coca-Cola or whatever. And so, it, you know, because legislation is weighted towards manufacturing, they don't have to reveal those ingredients to consumers. And those chemicals that are in fragrance, often called phthalates, spelled with a P-H-T-H-A-L-A-T-E-S, there are thousands of them in the industrial market. They do a lot of interesting things. They make plastics bendable, as one example, where BPA tends to make it harder. They also extend the scent or fragrance in many products. So among a lot of their functions, they are used to really keep that shelf life going for a long time and also on our bodies so that we like our colognes and perfume because we smell all day long. But they have been linked to hormone disruption as well as immune system disruption. And, you know, very low levels, but when you're using them every day in lots of different products, you're never really washing them out, even if they have a short half-life, like BPA is relatively short. So it's called pseudopersistence. You're constantly being bombarded by different areas that they're coming in. And so you really want to just work your way through what you're being exposed to and from which direction. Again, I do that with this book with 21-day plan because I'm trying to get people to say, oh, you start day one this, day two this, day three, you know, trying to get people to wrap their head around a very simple process.
Yeah. What about when you say fragrance, do you also mean like deodorants as well?
Yeah. Anything that has an odor is essential. I mean, it could be your, you know, dishwashing soap. It could be your laundry detergent. Scents are a $1 billion industry. I mean, they are literally infused into everything. In fact, in the States, you could walk in front of a store and they spray outside their building, you know, to pull you in, which, you know, in some states, actually in the workplace, the American Disabilities Act does not allow you to wear cologne or perfume if it bothers other workers. So there's lots of things that are tied to scent that we don't always think about. But in the workplace, it can be a problem. Outside of the workplace, in private owned stores, they actually spray it so they can get more customers in. So it's luring you in.
Yeah. I'm assuming the solution isn't to not wear any kind of scents or any deodorants or not wash your dishes. So what are some kind of solutions that we can implement in our daily lives?
So, you know, it's interesting. When I was doing edits for, you know, my book Detoxified, this is the US version, but you guys have a different version. Hopefully they'll send me my copy soon. It has a water spout on the front. It was interesting that they changed out the resources to look the products up, that you guys have a different database. And I can't think of the name off the top of my head, but it was sort of the equivalent of what we have here, which we have a lot of different free apps and we have a lot of websites that you can basically just go on and look up products either by what you want to use or you've been using to see if it is kind of rated higher in terms of toxicity or lower and decide what you want to do. Or you can make your own. I put some actually do-it-yourself recipes for all of this stuff, deodorant, personal care stuff, but also cleaning products in the book because you don't need that many ingredients like white vinegar and sea salt. You know, it's not complicated. But for people who really want to swap out, which is another part of what I teach, you know, without having to give anything up, you just want to try to find safer versions of what you're doing. And I teach high school and I throw products at them and they look them up and they talk amongst themselves and they come up with different solutions because there's so many good, clean products out there. It's just a matter of knowing how to have the right vetted resources.
Yeah, I guess it's kind of a ignorance in some way, not in like a bad way. People aren't choosing to ignore the signs. They're just being fed stuff, like easily accessible stuff, whether it's food, whether it's like cheap deodorant or canned tuna. You know, like we don't get taught, try to avoid those things. Here are the better alternatives, you know?
Oh, for sure. And listen, if doctors aren't being taught and the people that are supposed to be on the front lines of health, you can't expect everyday people to know this material. Like I wouldn't know anything about my computer system because I'm not a tech person, right? I pay an IT guy to help me get rid of viruses and all that. I think the problem is that, you know, unfortunately, because people are getting a little sicker than they should, even at younger ages, or maybe they just want to be healthy the rest of their lives and really work at that, you know, they just don't have great resources. And I think part of the problem is finding people that maybe are good messengers or people who write really intellectual, intelligent books or, you know, asking, you know, some of your websites where they're not selling products. You know, I've never sold products other than books and curriculum because I really felt strongly that if I'm going to move into the areas of education and academics, that I probably didn't want to be watered down with that. Conflict of interest. And, you know, I think there are many people out there that you and your friends and people listening will find very palatable in terms of who you want to listen to. And hopefully they'll be giving good information that's not tied to products or some kind of commercial gain.
Yeah. Yeah, hopefully. you mentioned kind of immune disruptors and also briefly mentioned kind of hormonal disruptors. Can you kind of describe what hormonal or endocrine disruptors are?
Yeah. So basically, as I was talking about a little bit earlier, the human body, and I talk about evolution, anthropology a lot. So forgive me if there are people listening who, you know, I don't mean to offend anyone's religion or origins, but I always start with, look, we've been here a long time, humans. And in that period of time, which I will, you know, say is around 4 million years, you know, we've come a long way in terms of having clean air, clean water. Our food was much more nutrient rich because we picked it out of the ground. We chased after chickens. Like we really were moving more, sweating more, more vitamin D on our skin. Quality of everything was better, right? Fast forward now to modern day times. We all live in it. But we really are looking at a lot of things that work against all the things that made human beings function properly. And so when it comes to these chemicals, which actually in our country and pretty much around the world, but I can speak to the history here, we had such a boom of chemical production after World War II. In the 1940s, it was when Monsanto and lots of companies really started making pesticides, naugahyde, rayon, plexiglass for fighter pilots so that they could fly with lighter aircraft. We had food storage capability that would reduce use of natural resources. We had plates that would not break if you dropped them. So it was great for housewives in the 1950s, right? So we've had a lot of chemicals come into our market, come into our products just in a very recent time. And that's a lot of change for the human body to manage in terms of just kind of foreign invaders making their way in. So back to your question, hormones have been part of the human existence. It's very ancient. Even estrogen and androgens have been around since humans have ever been around. And they work at such small doses to do huge things in the human body, because everything about evolution is about conserving energy so that you can evolve to the next generation. And so when it comes to energy, hormones really are the most powerful thing you can have to do anything in the human body. And we have lots of them. We have insulin for sugar management. We have thyroid hormone to manage metabolism. We have fertility hormones. We have growth and development. We have brain and brain development hormones. And we have hormones that affect our development of our male and female genitalia, and also hormones that affect our risk for hormone-sensitive cancers like breast cancer, testicular, prostate, you know, those kind of things, thyroid. So the idea that these chemicals were discovered to disrupt, and disrupt is a broad word, which was left open for all of the research that would follow from 25 years ago when they coined this. But it has a lot to do with upregulating receptors, downregulating receptors, intervening with physiologic pathways and communication, which is how, you know, hormones affect glands and organs. So that's really a lot of where endocrine disrupting chemicals, EDCs, was coined. Immune disruption chemicals, which I coined because I'd never seen it in the literature, is reframing a lot of the data that was already collected on many of the immune effects, but framing it towards, you know, what we're seeing epidemiologically in terms of, you know, these diseases developing. And so we see things like cytokine increase and inflammatory responses. We see even with the perfluoroalkyls, which are the forever chemicals, like non-stick chemicals, stain guard chemicals, that they decrease the body's ability to make antibodies when you get vaccinated. So there's lots of different effects that can come about, but it's reframing the immune system and the endocrine system in terms of how these chemicals basically disrupt normal physiology, normal function. And by the way, these systems talk to each other. So, you know, it's not to say that the endocrine system is a soloed, you know, siloed system. They all talk to each other. You know, you have all these systems communicating. So anywhere these chemicals intervene can potentially cause a cascade of events. So that was really the framing of the book.
Yeah. Do you think the kind of long-term implications, there's some really big impacts to our health that's still yet to be discovered, because, you know, a few decades time we might look back and be like, oh wow, there's a lot more health implications than we realized. Maybe similar with like tobacco and cigarettes, it took a few decades to really know the true extent to the implications. Do you think that's going to happen with toxic?
You know, I would say that third-party testing, academic testing, NIH-funded testing, unfortunately, we're having a real problem with science being cut off at this time in terms of some of the most important cancer prevention studies, you know, environmental chemical exposure studies. And we're also having, you know, a bit of rollback when it comes to oversight with exposures in manufacturing. So when you combine those issues where you have less science and less investigation and more, you know, less regulation overall in manufacturing, it really can potentially be a problem. So I'm hopeful that we're still going to be able to come up with this data and that there's going to be funding for it. But I will say this, and I get asked this a lot, especially now with the politics in the U.S., right? Really, really contentious on every level, right? But when it comes to regulation, I always encourage it. I always want red dye number 3 to be taken on the market if the science supports it. I always want certain chemicals in the water system to be, you know, mandated, managed, remediated. But here's the thing, it will not be able to do, we can't get enough regulation to manage the problem. In other words, the horse left the stable. You know, we have to do this for ourselves in a very reasonable way, nothing to get scared about, but do it in a way that you're providing agency over your own body and your own choices and not waiting to be saved, you know?
Yeah, definitely. That leads me to another question I thought of. If you were able to decide what foods and drinks could be banned with no public backlash or political backlash, what would you ban instantly? There's probably quite a long list, but I'm just curious to know.
Oh, geez. Well, I think one of the things that I talk about the most here is water quality, because it's not so much banning, it's really upregulating, you know, the ability to clean water at our wastewater treatment plants. I do realize that it's very hard to fix an infrastructure even in around the world, right? Because if you even add one chemical that needs to be managed, you're really changing the entire process by which water gets cleaned. So I'm still in the school that you want to clean water when it hits your home, your apartment, your school, before you drink it, is right where that filtration process should go on, and they don't have to be expensive. Banning, oh gosh, there are so many chemicals to ban. I would say overall, I think, you know, banning chemicals like BPA, where it's in every canned food, it's one of the highest production volume chemicals there is. And it's not just in the food system. I think if you can get rid of, they got rid of BPA in plastic baby bottles here in the U.S. in 2012. My co-author was largely responsible for that, for some books that we wrote together. But unfortunately, we have all these regrettable substitutions. So they came up with BPS, BPSIP, BPF. And so unless you get rid of the whole class of bisphenols, which is thousands, and have replacements that can do the same function, we're going to be left without, you know, with a lot of unhappy consumers as well as manufacturers in many ways.
Yeah, so that's the kind of another problem, isn't it? Because once you ban one thing, they just replace it with another suboptimal compromise, like with the BPA.
Right, and that's allowed in our community. I mean, in the EU, you have much more oversight in terms of regulation. You have more chemicals that are removed or not allowed than in the States, U.S., I also learned recently from people who are in the food packaging community of researchers that, you know, one of the key issues is that in the EU, the studies of science in terms of harm is taken care of by one body, and the management and regulation of that stuff is really a separate body. And that's really critical and beneficial, because then you have people doing their job without bias. Where in the U.S., those two components are actually done in the, you know, at the EPA, you have the researchers inside doing the management regulation. When it's not there, it's not unbiased in terms of how they drop, different changes. So I think that's another really key issue, the difference between the two countries and EU, I'm sorry, with the U.S.
Yeah, yeah. Well, why is BPA used so much and why is it so widespread?
Because it works. I mean, It's one of those things where when a chemical gets part of production, it is so hard to take it out of production because it's been used for so long and it has this purpose of, at least in canned foods, as an example, it lines the interior. So it protects the food and drink in that can from the metal exterior. It was designed to prevent botulism, which is a bacteria that can occur if you have dented cans. So it was sort of like a layer of protection before, you know, the can gets damaged. But, you know, no one wants to change the food packaging. We don't even think about food packaging. We're so consumed with food chemicals themselves that people aren't even thinking that one of the biggest ways to get exposed to BPA is actually from the food packaging itself. And so I think that a lot of these chemicals, they're just, you know, they were designed in the chemistry lab, they do a function that they were looking for, and then it's very hard to make replacements. There's a compound called oleoresin, which is basically, a vegetable-based interior lining, but it adds somewhere between 2 and 10 cents per can in terms of cost. And so, again, when it comes down to the bottom line, people would rather use the cheap stuff because no one's really paying attention.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, hopefully that changes. But again, like you said, it's going to take a long time. We should take the initiative. Do you think there's almost... I don't know if this is the right word. I learned it in psychology a few years ago, almost like an agentic shift where we kind of think, oh, the big agencies and the government, they know what they're doing. They'll be giving us like safe food, even though it's wrapped in plastic. Do you think that's a big problem with a lot of the public?
Yeah, I think, look, we're all human. We're all busy. We're all so, you know, distracted by our own lives and work and survival. Like, I get it. I mean, I was that person 15 years ago. I was so, you know, I just relied on other people to do the work and or just made the assumption. I had high expectations and I was sort of mourning the process of what happens in the U.S. market over the last 15 years because it was kind of like finding out Santa doesn't exist, right? Because you want to know that something was there and that you looked forward to having that in place. But to be honest with you, I think being, you know, unlearning is a really great pursuit I think it shows intellect when you can learn something and share that with others, as long as it's, you know, obviously vetted in, I believe, science. And so unlearning things is really takes courage, you know, and it takes power to wrap your head around it. It took me years because I was so part of the Western system. I mean, from a family of doctors, married to a doctor, brother's a doctor, parents and cousins. You know, I just relied on the system to really give me what I needed and no more. And I found out that there's all these other areas of healing. There's all these other area tools for people to think about when it comes to our health. You know, Ayurvedic, Chinese medicine, exercise, sleep management is so critical to human health. Drinking water, all of these things, stress management, they matter. The gut microbiome matters. And that's why I feel like I found a community, lots of people now who understand the science. It's just taken a while.
Yeah. You mentioned sleep there. How important is getting your 8 hours, eight plus hours for kind of getting rid of toxics?
Yeah. You know, 8 hours is great. You know, for younger people, it's upwards of 9, 10, 11 hours, believe it or not. I mean, ask my teenagers, they don't get any of that. That's the goal, right? Younger brains need more time to develop. But when it comes to chemicals, it's interesting because the brain and the spinal cord are separated from the bloodstream and it's surrounded by fluid called cerebral spinal fluid. It's kind of clear. People get spinal taps and it's clear. It's not blood that comes out. That material actually is also called the glymphatic system in and around the brain, which clears out a lot of chemicals we now know. Again, science develops, science moves on. We start to see great, cool findings. We now know that when we sleep, we actually clear a lot of the chemicals we're exposed to during the day. And so that's really remarkable because that means not only do we want good quality sleep and long sleep because we feel rested, our memories are better. Our response to pain evaluation is actually lower, believe it or not, when you have less sleep. I mean, more sleep, you feel like your perceptions are better for pain. There's so much good from sleep, but now we have this added benefit of being sort of a cleaning system at night. So I encourage people to really consider, you know, how much value on sleep we give it, because we often take it for granted. I did, everyone does, but it's something to really use as a tool for detoxifying, actually.
Yeah, it's definitely an asset for not just that, but everything, like you said, like memory and learning and stuff. And I think, especially people my age, and probably people older as well, maybe type A's a lot of the time as well, we just think, oh, we can do everything all at once. And, oh, it doesn't matter. I can work on 6 hours sleep. It's fine. Let me just spend a few more hours like studying or practicing whatever I'm doing. And, you know, if we actually give ourselves time to get a bit more sleep, that's going to obviously compound and benefit us over time, not just for our health, but for our sociability and our memory and stuff. So,
yeah. You know. And look, life is fluid and you're going to go through periods in your life where you know, you're going to be up all night for a paper, or you're going to be out partying, or maybe, you know, you're going to have a child and you're going to be up all night taking care of a baby. I mean, there's so much about life that's so fluid, you know? And so one of the things that I talk about in the book, out of my four A's of environmental health navigation, the fourth A is allow. It's doing all of the assess, which is the first, avoid or swap for products and that kind of thing for the second A. The third A is what we add in, nutrition, diet, certain foods that are powerhouses, sleep, all that. But the fourth A is allow. And allow is saying, you know what? You don't have to be perfect. 80-20 is certainly fine. Life is fluid. And when you give yourself a little pat on the back and you say it's okay to have birthday cake and to travel and not always be, you know, this is not about perfection, it actually motivates people to do more of the big lift. So I had to have that psychological piece, I think, because it's such a broad and big topic, in order to keep the positive momentum.
Yeah, because otherwise the activation energy to do the things you're like kind of encouraging, it would be so high if you've kind of fall into that over-optimization trap and just you end up in.
I think it works against a lot of people in the health and wellness world too. I think there's a sense in medicine as a doctor with colleagues and healthcare people that it's almost putting blame on the patient if they can't keep up a standard that is super high. And I think it's just so unfair. And then you're lopping on pressure on top of someone managing a condition. And so I want to pull back on that and say, you know what, if you reframe the situation that you're doing really well and you're doing the best you can, it's a journey for everybody, and take your time and It's not a diet. You want this to be part of your lifestyle. I think all of that makes people's perception of their own condition and pain control even improved, because you're putting people on a positive cycle. And the institutions sometimes I find are very daunting in the way that they frame your health as being your own fault. So I don't love that.
Yeah. I was just wondering, actually, have you done any studies on kind of caffeine? Is there anything negative in terms of toxics or toxins in caffeine or in coffee that could potentially pose a problem, not just on our sleep, but on our overall health?
There's so many environmental toxins. You could go into smoking and alcohol, but you could also say sugar. You could also say caffeine, things that we are, socially acceptable. I would say that caffeine is certainly a drug. It's always been designed and manufactured and used as a drug. It's, even though it's in our food system, it has certain purposes, of course, to keep us awake. But when you take too much, it can be deadly. And in fact, I had in med school, there was someone, we stay up late, we studied for days, major exams. And, in this particular case, someone had, one of my classmates had drank a whole pot of coffee over the course of a nighttime trying to stay up awake and study. And they had such overdosed in caffeine that it was really dangerous. I mean, palpitations, cardiac issues. I mean, it revs you up to the point where your metabolism can really be overwhelming in terms of, basic functions. And so that person got pretty sick. So it's not so much I would think that most people are doing that, but I would say that caffeine has a very long half-life, so to speak. So it lasts in your system for even 8 to 10 hours. So when you're having your last cup of tea or coffee, but probably more so coffee in terms of caffeine, you want to make sure it's early enough. So believe it or not, so that you don't wake up your sleep cycle or mess with your sleep cycle, because you want your sleep cycle to be natural. You want to kind of close down to sundown to, all of your work activity. So many people rev up to caffeine, and then they do downers to go to bed, sleep aids and medications and melatonin and all that. And technically, we want to work our bodies around not having to use those kind of compounds.
Yeah. So it's the half-life 8 to 10 hours. I always thought it was six hours.
It's variable. I think it depends on how much caffeine. I can't give you the exact numbers, but, one cup, what's one cup? My husband loves coffee and his one cup is 20 ounces. Like, what do you... Like 4 cups. So I think it's kind of like, I don't drink. Really? Well, how about 6 beers and 2 vodkas? Vodka tonics. I don't know if that's not drinking, maybe compared to your buddy Joe or whatever. So I think it really is a matter of relative to the amount of ounces of actual alcohol. I think that has to be looked into, or caffeine per drink. And there's also decaf has some caffeine. Even if you're not supposed to have any, it's allowable to have some. So you can have lots of decaf and find out that you're wired and find out that you're just more sensitive too. So all of those variables. But I think giving yourself a stopping point and knowing how much you're taking, I think is a way to start the process of even reduction if you want to.
Yeah. Well, say you had your last coffee at 1 p.m. and its half-life is 6 hours. At 1 a.m., wouldn't a quarter of the caffeine still be in your brain?
For sure. You're talking about half-life, right? So 50% of what your dose is your half-life. So if your half-life is 6 hours, and 6 hours, only half of what you originally taken in is still in your system. Another 6 hours is only half of the last amount. So you're always going to have some in your system until it's completely washed out. So yeah, half-lives matter, and how much you metabolism, sweat, urinate, how much, other medications you're on, whether or not, your body works well to get rid of those things also matters. So, my general rule is for every one cup of caffeine you have, not cup, you want to have equal amounts of water, clean filtered water, because you're offsetting some of the dehydration that goes along with this. I mean, dehydration is really critical in older people. If you have a lot of tea, like in your country and in the UK, tea is like, but there's a lot of people who fall in the U.S., at least. I can't speak to you, it's the U.K., but there's a lot of people who fall because they drink tea instead of water, not realizing that the caffeine is dehydrating. Then they stand up and they fall and fracture. So understanding that one cup to one cup of water to replenish is really kind of an important thing, no matter what age you're at.
Yeah, definitely. Switching topic a little bit, microplastics. So could you go a bit into kind of microplastics, when it was kind of, when they were kind of discovered or like found in the human body? I did read like maybe a year or two ago that microplastics have been found to cross the blood-brain barrier. Is, I just wanted to know if that was true and what could be the causes of that.
We got all good stuff now. I mean, look, I don't know when they were first discovered, but they certainly made the headlines in the last year in a big way, because some of the better studies are coming out now. And we're actually looking for them now because we want to see how they play into dementia and Alzheimer's. And brain health was really the first reason people started looking, because they found at autopsy people had microplastics in their brains. And then they were trying to figure out if it correlated with dementia, Alzheimer's, Parkinson's, and a lot of brain-related, degenerative diseases. But what they found out more recently is that they, you know, at dissecting placentas, there's microplastic. When you look in the bloodstream, we have upwards of, like, you know, they say a credit card per week in the blood of humans, which seems like an awful lot, but it's kind of sending the point home that we are getting filled with plastics, and they are getting caught in places like the brain where you have smaller vessels. They're getting caught in what are called atheromas, which are sort of fat, pockets that were discovered when they were doing open heart surgeries, and they were taking the fat chunks and sending them to pathology and finding out there's microplastics. And we're getting better at detecting even nanoplastics, which are smaller than microplastics, because a lot of detection has to do with what are the assays we have to detect. Otherwise, we don't think it's there unless we have a way to detect it, right? Same with chemicals. So, you know, that was really a big push. And so once they started looking, we have breast tissue, we have, this is always fun, testicular, you know, tissue in the testes. I mean, it's like once it gets to men, it's like, oh boy, now we got to start really looking into this.
Yeah.
I mean, that's my bias. But anyway, yeah. I mean, the idea is like, you know, it's everywhere in our human body. The question is going to be, and I have a huge section on this, not so much huge, but I have a big section on this in the book where I say, look, this is the issue. This is where it's at. And this is what we can do about it. Storage in glass and stainless steel, carrying our water in glass and stainless steel, not microwaving, you know, foods, vegetables, whatever in plastics. Not buying necessarily hot soup from a restaurant or takeout, trying to avoid takeout packaging by bringing your own stainless steel container. I mean, the list goes on, and I have that all in the book, but it's more about creating habits in your home and products in your home that reduce plastic exposure.
Yeah, and can it cause really bad health implications such as cancer? Is there any studies on that?
Well, what's interesting about plastics is we all think of plastic as some kind of hard material that doesn't break down. But the reason it's microplastics in the first place is because it broke down. And we also know that the chemicals that make up plastics, whether it's phthalates I was mentioning to make them bendable, or BPA, which makes them sturdy, they also are infused with lots of chemicals like antibacterials. If you want to keep bacteria, cutting boards, plastic cutting boards are often loaded with antibacterial chemicals, almost like antibiotics, really. Which we don't want to be exposed to, or else we won't respond to antibiotics when we actually need them. That's called bacterial resistance. But they're also infused with, you know, a bunch of other chemicals, colors, and all these things. They can be recycled too. So for instance, lots of headlines now about dark or black plastic utensils and bowls that are really an amalgam of multiple plastics being melted down together. And certainly black covers up any colors from lots of different products. They tend to be, at this point, considered more harmful because they are a mixture of so many other plastics. Here's the thing. Because they're not transparent, we don't know what they're made of, we don't know what they're infused with, we can't really do great studies unless someone wants to take that on. Certainly not in humans, because in humans, there's too many variables. So animal studies would be ideal. But we know the chemicals that make them up cause problems. So we can take that information and run with it, you know?
Yeah. What are some food and drinks that are really high in microplastics that you research?
Food and drink. Well, it's been discovered in beers. It's been it's certainly discovered in any plastic bottles containing food, certainly canned foods. We know microplastics exist. where else? It's in our air quality. I mean, people don't realize that even nanoplastics, you know, they're in the air. If you live near manufacturing, it could be in a lot of different places. Not like you're going to stop breathing, but I'm saying that just the vast swath of exposures to microplastics, but predominantly it's food and water. Even our infrastructure in the U.S. doesn't have an ability to manage microplastics. So whatever you get when it comes to your tap water. But certainly single-serve plastics that we, you know, run around and take out, which I do too. A lot of our food in the supermarket is packaged in plastic, so I rinse them off. So there's little things you can do that can actually reduce those levels.
Are there any, like, new technologies or products that have found the way to kind of filter out microplastics that could be groundbreaking?
This is a great question. I think this is the mad rush by water companies, water filter companies. I've met with a few of them. You know, it's really something that they have to come up with the right amount of material. Look, reverse osmosis is arguably the most aggressive way to clean water in the U.S. And around the world. We use reverse osmosis water for dialysis patients who need it the most to protect them from infections. But they also can, you know, take off some of the bigger compounds. So I would say that reverse osmosis is becoming the way to go if you want to filter your water, and may very likely will be evaluated for microplastics as we move forward, since it's become such an important topic.
Yeah, I think if a company can really efficiently and effectively solve that problem, that will end up being in a lot of homes and very lucrative for the company. So there's no reason not to try and do it.
Companies, I'd like to be a spokesperson for those companies, but I don't think they exist yet. So just, you know, you be my agent, my broker, go for it.
Yeah. Speaking of water, actually, what are some other kind of harmful toxics that is found in water? Maybe like, for example, fluoride, and what are the health implications of those?
Yeah, in terms of fluoride, it's funny. I didn't know how much is added to your water systems around, you know, Europe, you know, but apparently that was edited into the book, some of that research. You know, fluoride was never meant to be in the human body. It does, it's essentially, the argument was that it helps fix teeth, and it does, in fact, help to create, you know, stronger teeth, less dental caries, but there's other ways to get fluoride onto your teeth. I mean, there's certainly topical is what we do in the United States, and we don't really need to be drinking fluoride, which basically, you know, knocks off some of these fluorinated components, like thyroid has iodine functional, you know, so we fluoride can affect the thyroid function. It can affect other parts of the human body and certainly the brain function. And it's been identified in pregnant women. It's been identified as a contributor to decreased IQ and some other developmental issues in pregnancy. So, you know, I do not want any of my pregnant patients to be drinking fluorinated water. In fact, a good reverse osmosis filter will also take that off. Around the world, they've been removing fluoride, you know, from water systems. I mean, left and right. I mean, the data is just really remarkable. So I do think people should be thinking about that. I mean, certainly fluoride is just one of many. We have chlorine that's added, which intentionally to reduce pestilence, but we want to remove that once it gets to your glass, right? You don't want to, they send it out and then it goes to your home, but you really want to kind of remove some of those things and detergents and other things added to clean water. Lead and lead piping, you know, certainly we have change out to PVC, but polyvinyl chloride is not a great substitute. It has its own risks. Kind of like my dog's toy was polyvinyl chloride, right? We don't want that in our bodies. And so again, the solution is not to worry so much about what your home is necessarily being inundated with, or changes of season or floods or climate change, which affects chemicals in our environment, our water, but to do it in your home, you know, to clean it once it hits your house, your apartment, and they're not expensive anymore. So, you know, I do encourage people to prioritize water even so much more than like other things that you use less.
Yeah, definitely. And do you know when fluoride was added to a lot of water, and was it just added because of the benefit to the teeth and not without any research about the potential health impacts? Was it just...
Oh, you know, these are tough questions because I don't keep it all in my brain and I'm a lot older than you. So I don't recall it being added for other reasons other than for the dental world. I don't know how people stumbled across this. you know, I don't want to have any conspiracy theories behind it, but, you know, I never really trust some of these things that are added into our system sometimes when, you know, unless I understood sort of the public health benefits. So for example, in the U.S., there was iodine, which was added to bread and to table salt, was actually a really important public health measure because it actually gets into our thyroid gland and actually protects it from a lot of environmental chemicals. But back in the day, also goiter, which was a diagnosis where you didn't have enough iodine. We don't make iodine. We have to get it from food. And so that was a public health measure that anyone could look up on Wikipedia or what have you and understand that that was actually a reasonable, well-studied addition to the food system. But no one eats bread anymore and no one eats table salt. They eat sea salt, Celtic, and kosher sea salt. So that doesn't have iodine. And so now we're back to having a real problem with iodine. So I talk about that in the book because I want people to think about micronutrients. But fluoride is not a nutritional valuable that I'm aware of in terms of human health. It could help with teeth, but you can also get it in different ways, like topical, you know, at the dentist instead of mass, you know, release of it throughout the water systems.
Yeah. What are some other underrated or overlooked micronutrients?
Vitamin D, certainly. I mean, vitamin D3, actually, to be exact, is what we have over the counter. Vitamin D2 is a prescription, but that has to turn into vitamin D3. So I prefer the active form. Vitamin D3 is something that humans, anthropologically, we're getting much more of. We don't get that anymore at the levels that we actually need to be, you know, healthful for our immune system. D is very critical to the immune system function. Lots of other things as well. But we're often low. I mean, I haven't met any human coming through my office that was tested and was, you know, having a normal value or at least normal, meaning where it's healthful. So they were always at the bottom of the range of, say, 30 to 100. They'd be at 30 and doctors would say, oh, you're fine. The argument really is that you want to be at a high normal level for vitamin D level if you get blood tested. But that's something that's really a condition of modern day living. We're not outdoors. We wear sunscreen that blocks it. Our food is deficient. And so you're starting to see really how a lot of modern day life is causing us to not have the nutrients that make us work well and thrive and keep us healthy. And then you add in chemicals. So my book, my teaching, everything I do, curriculum that I do for The Smart Human, which is my website, The Smart Human, I'm teaching people that you can't just take away things. You want to also add in the stuff that has been missing for some time.
Yeah. And what are some foods that are naturally high in vitamin D? Obviously, you want to get a lot of sunlight. And here in the UK, we don't get that other than this time of year. Most of the year, it's just cloudy, which is makes basically the whole population vitamin D deficient. What are some, obviously, you can take supplements, but are there any kind of organic foods really high in vitamin D that people can take?
You know, I would love to say, I think the sad part of the section on the book is that I have not seen enough, you know, people eat consistently. First of all, you got the food system, which is variable. So you don't always know if it's getting the nutrition it has in it, right? Soil quality, transport of food. So you can't always rely because of the food system, you can't rely on the foods themselves having the right amount. Then you have to be consistent with your life and taking it in every day and at the right amount and not missing a day. And, you know, like, there's so many variables to getting the ultimate goal is to get your blood level to live at a level that's where it works and to keep it there. Unfortunately, there's too many variables. So I've made the argument there are, you know, are a couple things that we need to take every day since, you know, from birth till death, very dramatic. Human fertilizer. I don't think it's crazy. I think it's well, vetted and highly researched, but it's very basic stuff. And it's part of this human evolution. Vitamin D3 is one of those and understanding why it's important and why we're not getting enough of it just from a routine diet.
Why vitamin D3 specifically? Do you know the reason why that one's so important?
Well, vitamin D3 as opposed to what else?
Oh, I don't know. I was just assuming that was vitamin D1, 2, and 3. So
there's different forms of vitamin D, and vitamin D that hits your skin turns into another type of D that goes to the kidneys, that goes to another vitamin D that goes to your liver. So there's actually a lot of different types of vitamin D compounds that transition through different components in your body until it gets to your bloodstream. And that too has its variability, right? Whether or not your kidney can convert it, whether or not your skin is converting, whether you have makeup on, whether you have sunscreen on. So again, that changes whether or not you get actually enough active form of vitamin D3 that's doing its job for a variety of reasons and, you know, for the immune system. So when I say take vitamin D3, it's the most active form. It's the kind is the end point, but you don't have to have it converted in the human body, which creates a lot of, you know, issues for some people.
Yeah. Okay. So are there any other kind of famous historical examples of toxics that have been once widespread and that have now been banned? Maybe like DDT. What are some like other examples?
Yeah, that's a good one. So in the US, there's only about 5 or 6 chemicals in the history of chemicals that have ever been removed. It's mean. Well, maybe add a couple cosmetic chemicals, but it is just insane. So DDT is on that list. Some forms of asbestos. We know lead, which used to be allowable in our water system at like 60 parts per million or parts per trillion. I talk about in the book, it has since come down because we know so much more about how lead affects the brain in terms of developmental issues and lots of other health issues that now it's down to 15. I don't know what the units are in our water system for maximum contaminant level, concentration level. And even that is considered to be not healthful because we know there's no safe level of lead in human exposure. So, you know, we've had that has taken 100 years to get to that point, and we're still not there.
Yeah.
That point of waiting until the science gets better. And a lot of this is, you know, science-based, but it's also some precautionary principle, which is we know enough without the hard and fast science that has to be paid for and has to be run in very meticulous ways. We know a lot that we could just say precautionary principle, if it sounds like a good idea to switch out or stop that behavior or whatever, then just do it, you know? And that's kind of built in to the messaging, you know, of what I share.
Yeah, that is why I love your work, because it kind of makes you rely on yourself to change things rather than relying on, like we were saying earlier, like bureaucratic governments or agencies. So yeah, no, it's
yeah,
really
it's
good.
Unfortunate. I mean, I wish I didn't have to say that, but you know, it's gotten, I've been through 3 presidents and 3, you know, health secretaries, and you know, it's not that anyone's not doing their best and trying, and maybe they'll get a win here and there, but it's just, come on, it's been 15 years and nothing's changed really. So I just encourage people to do it for themselves. Yeah.
100%. Yeah, no, I think that's the same with not just trying to detoxify your body, but also like everything in life. I think you just have to take control as much as you can.
It's kind of true. I teach that to my kids, but they, you know, don't listen and walk out the door. So, you know, maybe Jacob, you can talk to them.
Yeah. If they listen to the podcast, they might learn a few things about it. I'll do some episodes on it. But we mentioned actually earlier that the environment has changed so much in the last like 150 years or post-industrial revolution. And clearly our genetics and our bodies like haven't as much as environmental change has. And I was just wondering if you think environmental exposures to toxins has had a bigger impact on developing chronic diseases than genetics, or do you think it's an interplay and it's kind of too contextual and, you know, that's too much of a generalized statement? Do you think?
Yeah, that's a great question. What I say to people is, you know, whether or not we develop any type of illness or condition is really this dance between 3 things. It's our genetics, it's our lifestyle, and it's our environment and exposures. And I the reason I divide them out is because they all have a real play on this in terms of how we live our life and whether we are afflicted with anything. But we have control over all 3 and certainly 2. We can affect our lifestyle by choices, smoking, alcohol, chemicals. We can, as you say, smoking, alcohol, but also sort of exercise, stress management, that. We have the environment, which is more the chemical related, EMF, all those things that we can work on. Even our genetics, which I say you can't change your genes, but you can change and work on your epigenome, which is the proteins that sit on your genes and decide or help to manage whether those genes develop or express disease. And so we have control over those proteins. And I think that, and that has a lot to do with lifestyle and environment. So I'm trying to give people this idea that it's not like, oh, grandma had it or cousin Susie had it, or everyone had autoimmune and everyone had cancer. But guess what? That doesn't mean that's you. And it means that you have every opportunity to try to keep working to reduce those risks that contribute to those diseases, because you can keep genetic risk at bay by what we do and what we, you know, how we live our lives, for sure.
Yeah, I think that's really interesting how you mentioned like grandma got it or granddad got it, because like, you know, you can be, for example, my granddad, he died of prostate cancer, and that the doctors told my mum that me and my brother are genetically more susceptible of it. But what you're saying is like, it doesn't mean we're guaranteed to get it, does it? You know, like if we...
For sure. And I'm not saying God forbid you do get it, but I'm saying, you know, there are certain diseases that we know very, very classically through research that if your parents have this, then you're going to get it. I mean, there are one-to-one, you know, certain types of colon cancer, certain types of breast cancers. And that's because of the beauty of science that we've figured that out, right? You know, we've had genetic testing, we've had really great stuff. But for the vast majority of conditions, there's so much more involved with, you know, other components. For instance, you know, you said your grandfather, but you were also given genes passed down through your mother and your grandmother's side, you know, or I should say your grandmother, and two sides of the family that made up your mom and your dad. And so the idea is that we're sort of like a mutt of genetics, right? You know, we're mixture. We don't know how much one gene that's passed down is predominant over the others, you know, and it's very hard to get that on an individual basis and to scale that across populations. And so, again, it goes back to this idea, yes, you can have family history. I don't even barely ask about it anymore, because to me, unless it's one of those one-to-one connections, but we have so much more that we can offer the future generations by what we do now in this generation. And that's also a very important goal, because we know that these genes, these chemicals can affect that epigenome. And that's why we want to intervene on those changes as much as we can, for not just for us now, but for what we might have in the future in terms of children.
Yeah, definitely. And are there any, I've heard that cigarettes, for example, like inhaling cigarettes often can have a potential genetic kind of effect on your children. Is that the case?
Well,
is that true?
Certainly directly, if you're pregnant, that can be, their oxygen is contaminated with many of those chemicals. But, you know, cigarettes in and of themselves, again, proprietary blends, you're not going to know what's in them. But what we do know is in them is benzene, formaldehyde. Cadmium is very high. I have smokers that I test for cadmium, and it's very high when they give up smoking. You know, their cadmium levels go down. You can also get cadmium from dark chocolate, of course. So is it smoking or is it the dark chocolate, right? So this all goes to being kind of a savvy clinician and asking the right questions, getting a lifestyle history so you don't blame any one thing erroneously. But smoking in and of itself is filled with nicotine and a bunch of chemicals that we know that can be pretty harmful to the human body, certainly at high doses. So, you know, we want to be thinking about these exposures in a way that just makes sense. And I would never blame people who smoke. Like I have a really hard time blaming people who are addicted to things, because our brains are literally addicted. Some people are addicted to shoe shopping. I you know, used to be addicted to frozen yogurt in college. I mean, it was like insane, right? But I think the way you pull these things away from the brain is slow and deliberate, and have substitutions and peel it away from a brain that's, you know, really adapted to these exposures. I'm not a good cold turkey person. I always think that the brain has to sort of evolve, adapt, and keep moving. But there's so many ways to do these things where you're removing, like diet sodas. I was addicted to Diet Dr. Pepper for, God, 10 years. So we can all do it. It's just a matter of when to get started. When are you ready? Do you have substitutions that will suffice? And is it the right time in your life to get really in control of those things?
Yeah, well, I've been reading a book on like the power of routine, and it mentioned addiction, and it was saying how once it becomes an addiction and part of your routine, the kind of brain activity goes into your, like, I think it's called the basal ganglia rather than your prefrontal cortex, which is more primitive area.
The decision making. Behavior. Yeah.
Yeah. And this lady who went from being a massive smoker to completely just stopped it, was completely sober, didn't drink, didn't smoke. They kind of scanned her brain. And when they kind of tried to lure her into like doing stuff like trying to smoke, or like reminding her of smoking, or like maybe making her smell cigarette smoke or thinking about it, the area of her brain kind of did light up, like, oh, cigarette smoke, oh, smoking. But then another area of her brain, or another neural circuit.
Had excitement.
Yeah, kind of overrode it. And it was because a new habit had been formed, which was not smoking. So the original habit hadn't completely disappeared. It was still firing off in the brain, but it was just overriding it. And I think it was just really cool. And
neuroplasticity is when your brain is so similar to this conversation and about affecting our epigenome and affecting our health and our tissue and our immune system. Our brains are very, very plastic. I hate to use that word, but maybe not for microplastics, but the plasticity, meaning that I guess it comes from the same idea, right? Moldable. But, the neuroplasticity of our brains is pretty remarkable. I mean, they've done studies on meditation and how it changes brain waves. And, you know, there's so much cool stuff in science. You're totally on top of these things. I mean, this is the kind of exciting stuff that makes you empowered to take care of yourself, right? That, like, you know what? Life is not over because I'm addicted to this, or I grew up in this family, or I had this childhood trauma, that we can override a lot of what's happened to us and even what will happen to us by just knowing that our bodies are constantly, you know, changing in good ways too.
Yeah, for sure. And mentioning kind of earlier, you were saying how I can't remember the name of the chemical you said, but it dropped as soon as she stopped smoking. How quickly can toxins get flushed out of the body once we stop ingesting them? So, for example, once I stop eating tuna cans as much, how quickly are the mercury levels going to drop? Does it really depend on the toxic?
It depends on the individual chemical because they all have their own half-life of how long they break down. It also depends on where it's stored. So, for instance, mercury happens to be stored in muscle tissue. Lead happens to be stored in long bones, in the bones. And it actually, people are into bone broth here. It was like a big fad. There was a lot of books on it. And what people didn't realize is that when you boil down bones, you should know where those bones come from because they could have a lot of lead released into your bone broth. So you're, you know, trying to diet, lose weight and be healthy, and yet you're loaded with lead. So these are things that I guess people don't always realize. I certainly didn't. But how long it takes to detoxify your body really depends on a lot of factors, including what the chemical is about, what we know about it, half-life and otherwise, because we might not even know what the half-life is if it's not revealed to us. But it also depends on how much you're exercising, sweating, whether or not you're eating fiber, which binds a lot of harmful things and helps the gut move to clean out our lymphatic system, whether you have, you know, health conditions that work against you, autoimmune or maybe even metabolic issues, whether your kidneys are working properly, or your liver's working properly, whether you're drinking enough water. There's so many variables, but the idea is if you're pulling things away and you're sticking with that, your body is getting cleaner every day. Like you're making, and if you fall backwards and you have that allow where you go to birthday cake or travel, so what? You get back on the track when you come back, you know? So it's a process, it's a journey.
Is that the case for your life as well and your kind of diet and stuff? You know, you allow certain things.
I mean, I color my hair. I have to go to a lacrosse game in a couple hours where I'm gonna be on toxic tire crumb turf for the next 3 hours. I'm there like 5 times a week. The way I manage it is I don't touch the tire crumb and I make sure my kids wash with soap and water, which we hope ever happens. It's kind of like you work within the situation of your life and you can't be mad at yourself or regret, you know, especially if you have a kid with, you know, disability or you have cancer, you're managing any of the things that we're managing on a day-to-day basis. Life is a journey. This is what I try to follow. I try to do the best I can. If I falter, I just to get back up and try to do my good stuff again. And I think that's the only thing we can do in this situation. It's not defeatist. It's empowering to be not the victim, but the person in control of those choices.
Definitely. And I guess it's also making sure you don't fall back into that trap and say, you have that birthday cake, maybe you have it once, you don't have it 2 days in a row, because if it happens 2 or 3 days in a row, it's kind of another new formation of another habit, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's the judgment, you know, I'm trying to give people and myself included, the wiggle room to have a quality of life that is happy and fun and joyous and not filled with shame, regret, and, you know, resistance. You know, you really want to have a positive reinforcement for this process because it's not easy. Being healthy is work. I mean, who would ever have said that? But to be healthy in modern day times, we have to work at it. You know, it doesn't come easily. And so you have to choose what you're willing to work at and do it at your own pace, you know?
Definitely. Couldn't have said it better. To end, I normally do a few kind of quick fire questions. So the first one is, if you could advise your 20-year-old self on one habit to prevent future health issues, what would it be?
20? You're choosing 20? Holy. Yeah. Yeah, probably stop drinking at the time. I was really into partying and having a good time, and I did have a good time. But my future self, my 20-year-old self, you know, I think what I would have done differently, as I talk about in the book, is, you know, when I know better, I do better. But I probably would have prepared for pregnancy a little bit differently. Not that, you know, my kids are healthy, thank God. But, you know, in terms of potential future conditions they may develop, that's a part of that whole epigenetic component. I kind of wish that I didn't grow up with such junk food, that my family knew better. We didn't know then. And I wish that once I knew, I wish I'd shifted my knowledge earlier. But I, you know, I think that I don't live in regret. I just kind of say to other people, when you know better, you do better. And that applies to, I think, everyone. But that's what I would have told my 20-year-old. I would also said to my 20-year-old self, don't care what people think, do your thing. Because as you get older, you just keep moving and not hearing the noise. You have a mission, you have goals, you have things you love. And I think the more we spend time thinking about what others think in general, it does not help us with our own goals and our own lives and our own happiness. So, you know, that's what I would probably have told myself. Not that I ever cared too much about what people think anyway.
Very good advice. And it's something that a lot of young people struggle with. And it's something that I've had to kind of retrain my brain to realize as well over time, since maybe like 14 or 15. There's this thing called the spotlight effect, where, I don't know if you've heard of it, but where you think everyone's thinking about you and looking at you, but because everyone's thinking that, no one's looking at you or thinking about you.
Tell my kids, you know, I said no one has time. I even tell myself as I'm rolling out this book and running around, you have to keep in perspective, like, everyone's doing their own struggle. Everyone's doing their own thing. And so it really does help to believe that, you know, people are busy and they're not focused on critiquing you. They don't, you know, there's a lot to be said for that. And when they don't answer you back for emails or they don't call you back, not taking it personally because they themselves are rushing to get through their stuff too. So it also changes your perception of, you know, how people respond to you in some ways too. But for sure. Everyone is focused on, you know, survival, keeping their own missions alive. And it does take some of the burden off, I think, if you're trying to succeed in the world in certain areas.
Definitely. And I don't know, I'm sure you've got this as well, but you kind of create a lot of scenarios in your head, or maybe like your monkey brain is telling you, oh, someone's going to say this, and like you end up overthinking stuff. Then you realize once you like release the book or release the podcast, like you get so much positive feedback from it.
You don't know who your village is until they actually show up. I've had this remarkable experience of people showing up that I never would have expected, more so than the people that didn't show up that I wanted to show up. I think it way overpowered, you know, the positive was way much more than the negative. And yeah, I think it actually rekindled my perception of humanity, especially given what we're dealing with in the US with all of the drama. So it actually made me feel that I was part of a village that supported my work and gave me validation after 15 years. Not that I was looking for it, but nice. It is really nice, you know?
You deserve all the validation you're getting for your amazing work.
Tell that to my kids.
The second quick question is, what belief do you hold that others find controversial?
What do I say that again?
What belief do you hold that others find controversial?
A belief I hold that probably that chemicals cause harm. I mean, I think the vast majority of people, they don't get it. And it's not to blame them because I didn't get it. But, you know, listen, there are people that just don't want to support this message. And whether they're paid for by big ag or chemical companies, whether they don't like holistic people in general from, you know, their own experiences, because people do apply their own experiences to how they treat others. And so, you know, look, I have always felt the science is on my side. And when I have the science and the people I respect in the scientific world on my side, I feel like I'm superwoman. I can do what I need to do and I will fight through as long as I have that supporting me. So, you know, whatever you need, I think embrace it for the support for sure.
Definitely. And I think more people are going to realize what you're saying and how true it is. And like, they should really change life. I think hopefully, you know, year after year, decade after decade, people are going to start changing their behavior. And that's already happening now, the more we're finding out. And social media has definitely helped that as well, for sure.
For sure. And yeah, and so I'm glad that it's been drawing attention. I just worry about people who are promoting detoxes and cleanses and things that I think are really to make money using fear as the motivator. I don't use anything in terms of products or endorsements. I want people to just use their own physiology and think about anthropology and sweating. And, you know, the things that we have in us is the cheapest and easiest way to get started, right?
Yeah.
That's me where you get started. You don't need teas and high colonics and wackadoodle stuff. You just really need to just understand how your body is brilliant.
Just focus on the fundamentals.
Sure.
Last question. You've clearly dedicated a lot of your life to like creating this amazing work. You said you spent 15 years researching, and obviously medicine takes a long time to study and qualify for. And it's really admirable. What have you sacrificed to pursue your dreams and this work of yours?
To be honest, I don't think much, because I always knew that I was doing it for the right reasons, and I never had a goal. I had no expectations. So I didn't disappoint myself or skirt things. I had two beautiful kids. I always wanted a family. I have a happy marriage. Well, reasonably happy. We'll fight later. We'll see. but the idea is that, you know, I don't think that I sacrificed so much. Look, I sacrificed time to study, time to take boards. But I always loved the human body. I came from a family that really respected human physiology, medicine. And so to me, when you love what you do, it's not work. That's a kind of, I know, cliche, but it's true. I just always love, and I'm a lifelong learner, so I love learning stuff like you do. I love learning about new things. And to me, that's not painful and it doesn't take away from other things. So, you know, hopefully I didn't really lose too much in other areas because I was always interested in this stuff. So it filled my soul, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. I agree. Do work that feels like play. 100%. In terms of like family and balancing, how have you managed that, you know, working hard and also balancing family time with it?
I think financially, I probably could have made a lot more money doing different choices in my career in medicine. I could have built a big practice. I chose not to. I could have done a lot of work for people. Then I wouldn't have had control over my time. I think I set myself up to be in control with a very small, manageable practice so that I could always write and do creative aspects within medicine. And that, I think, has changed everything. And I think it's because I don't care so much about big ticket items, fancy stuff, that I feel I've been able to do what I want to do for my emotional and heart reasons. So I think it just depends on what people want in their lives. You know, I just didn't need, I enjoy the fake bags better than the real bags because I, the system. So call me crazy. That's how I come up. But like when I'm walking around with a great fake bag, I'm laughing at all the people who spent $1 zillion on the real one.
Yeah.
Crazy? I don't know.
No, it's true. I mean, I think there's a big trend that's happened in the soccer or football world is these like fake like t-shirts, because if you buy the soccer top or football top from the actual team, it's like £100. Then you can get one for like £20 and it's the exact same.
I feel bad because I know certain companies will lose out on the fakes, but these are companies that, at least for the bags, they're not 100% identical. So they're sort of like their own twist on things. But again, you have to decide what you want in life. And material goods have never been such a major part of my life. And so I think that saved me in many ways in terms of my choices for me.
Yeah, it's a very good philosophy. Dr. Ailey Cohen, ladies and gentlemen, Ailey, I absolutely love your work and I hope the audience learned as much as I have. Yeah, so.
Sure, it's a different cover for you.
Yeah, again, I was going to say, where can people go to find your work and your amazing books?
Thank you. And so Amazon, I'm sure you have that there in Europe. And Amazon is really the ideal place to purchase lots of books very quickly. We have Barnes & Noble here. I don't know if you have that there, but there's lots of vendors that I would love to support, local bookshops, you know, certainly take advantage of all that. But Amazon is definitely the easiest. So, and I can be found, I'm in the United States, but I'm in Princeton, New Jersey, and I've actually done a lot of telemedicine consults around the world because we just have to organize the time difference, which can be a nightmare. But I actually act as a lot as a sort of a second opinion as a consult for people who are interested. They just can reach me through my my office website is Ailey, A-L-Y, Cohen, C-O-H-E-N, M-D.com. So A-L-Y, Cohen, M-D.com. Otherwise, follow on The Smart Human Instagram, The Smart Human TikTok, and the website, thesmarthuman.com. If you want to take some courses, I have mini courses on environmental health, radiation, and EMF, and all that stuff. So if people are interested, go to the website, you'll find me. Thank you.
Oh, notes below. I was just also wondering, are you going to write another book?
I think a lot of it depends. Right now, I'm so burnt out. This is my out of three. But, you know, I have been thinking about doing one for parents and hitting a younger bracket. And I think a lot actually depends if you do well in this book, whether or not you get a commercial publisher to take on another book. So the jury's out on that. I can always self-publish. But right now, all I can think of is like having 2 or 3 months of the summer where I'm not expected to edit on a Saturday for 8 hours. Yeah. So I'm looking forward to a little break before I get back into stuff. But I do love that work. So the answer is probably yes.
Yeah, well, whatever you release, I'll be sure to help you promote it and also read it. So thank you so much for coming on the show. Really appreciate it, Ailey.
Jacob, thank you for your interest. Wonderful questions. I hope this reaches a lot of people. And you're doing great work yourself. So thank you again.